11th, 4 days before Palestinians commemorated the 74-year anniversary of the Nakba, the Arabic word for catastrophe. On May 15th, Palestinians mourned the violent founding of the fabricated regime of Israel on Palestinian land. For 25 years, Abu Aqila had documented the Zionist regime's war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territory for Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera reported Abu Aqila herself embodied Palestinian humanity by speaking truth to power. She was covering an arrest operation by the Zionist regime forces near the entrance to the Jenin refugee camp when she was assassinated. Although she was wearing a flak vest marked press, an Israeli regime military sniper shot her below the ear. The only part of her head not covered by her protective helmet, clearly evidencing an intent to kill. Al Jazeera journalist Shata Hanaisha, also wearing a helmet and vest labeled as press, tried to reach Abu Aqila, but the Zionist regime troops did not stop firing even after she collapsed, she said. I couldn't even extend my arm to pull her because of the shots. The army was adamant on shooting to kill. Alia Samoudi, another journalist with Al Jazeera, who was also wearing a press vest, was shot in the back while covering the same event as Abu Aqila. He survived and is being treated for his wounds. Thousands of mourners came out to honor Abu Aqila. To add insult to injury, as her casket was being carried through the streets, the Zionist regime occupation forces attacked them, beating and kicking the mourners, then forcing pallbearers to nearby drop the coffin. Now, the occupying power has spoken back by shooting her in the head and attacking her mourners, a response that can only be classified as acute and multi-eared state savagery. In keeping with Israelis' modus operandi of refusing to let Palestinians live, die, or be buried in peace, writes Belen Fernandez at Al Jazeera. Assassinations or extrajudicial executions constitute war crimes under the Geneva Conventions. On March 3, 2021, Fatou Bensouda, the former ICC chief prosecutor, had announced that the ICC was mounting an investigation into war crimes committed in the West Bank, including East Al-Quds and the Gaza Strip, since the Zionist regime's 2014 Operation Protective Edge, during which the Zionist regime forces killed 2,251 Palestinians. Bensouda found a reasonable basis to believe that the Zionist regime forces committed war crimes, including willful killing, willfully causing serious injury, disproportionate use of force, and the transfer of Israelis into Palestinian territories. Bensouda also determined there was a reasonable basis to investigate war crimes, including intentional attacks against civilians using civilians as human shields and torture and willful killing by the Zionist regime forces. In October 2021, the Zionist regime designated six Palestinian human rights groups as terrorist organizations with absolutely no evidence. This was done in retaliation for their support of the ICC investigation and the boycott, divestment and sanctions, or BDS movement. The BDS movement was launched by 170 Palestinian civil society organizations in 2005. It called for boycott, divestment, and sanctions described as non-violent punitive measures that will last until the Zionist regime complies fully with international law by, first, ending its occupation and colonization of all Arab lands and dismantling its barrier wall, 85% of which is on Palestinian land. Two, recognizing the fundamental rights of Arab-Palestinian citizens in occupied territories to full equality. And three, respecting, promoting, and protecting the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their land as mandated by United Nations General Assembly Resolution 194. The killing of Abu Aqile has led to calls for an independent, impartial investigation and galvanized opposition to the Zionist regime's illegal occupation of Palestine. On May 13th, UN human rights experts condemned Abu Aqile's killing, saying it is part of a continuation of the high rate of attacks against media workers, particularly Palestinian journalists. More than 40 Palestinian journalists have reportedly been killed since 2000, with hundreds injured or targeted for violence. The UN experts included four special rapporteurs. One, on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territory occupied since 1967. Two, on the extrajudicial summary or arbitrary executions. Three, on violence against women, its causes and consequences. And four, on the promotion and protection of the right to freedom of opinion and expression. They said Abu Aqile's killing may amount to a war crime and demanded a prompt, independent, impartial, effective, thorough, and transparent investigation. Authorities have an obligation not to harm journalists and to protect them from harm under international humanitarian law and international human rights law, the rapporteurs noted. They added that the targeting of journalists working in the occupied Palestinian territory and the Zionist regime's failure to properly investigate killings of media personnel violate the rights to life and to effective remedies. Decrying the litany of extrajudicial executions, they said the safety of journalists is crucial to guaranteeing the rights to freedom of expression and media freedom. Noting that 2021 marked the highest number of Palestinian deaths since the Zionist regime's 2014 Operation Protective Edge, the experts declared, "The unsustainable situation is inherent to the extent of protracted military occupation in which violence and repression are used to perpetuate a system of Palestinian subjugation. They call for dismantlement of the occupation, including the Gaza blockade and the illegal settlements in the West Bank and East Al-Quds." More than 6,000 people have signed a statement initiated by the anti-war and anti-imperialist group Code Pink, calling for a thorough and impartial investigation of Abu Aqile's killing and the immediate suspension of the United States military aid to the fabricated regime of Israel. The U.S. enables the Israeli war crimes and its illegal occupation by providing it with $3.8 billion in unconditional military assistance annually, in spite of the classification of Israel as an apartheid regime by leading human rights organizations, including Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and the Israeli group B'Tselem. The Palestinian BDS National Committee, BNC, said Abu Aqile's killing amounts to war crime, a willful killing under the ICC's Rome Statute. BNC called for accountability for the perpetrators, those who gave the orders, and the entire political leadership of apartheid Israel. Though Israel killed Shirin Abu Aqile, her blood is also on the hands of the enablers, funders, and defenders of apartheid, primarily the US, EU, UK, Canada, and Australia. BNC noted in a statement, adding, "We call for public BDS pressure to end the West colonial hypocrisy and shameless complicity in the Zionist regime crimes and ongoing Nakba against indigenous Palestinians." BNC condemned the Western indifference to Palestinians, which enables the Zionist regime's impunity, directly contributing to ongoing Nakba. "We reiterate our call for meaningful solidarity with Palestinians facing ethnic cleansing, massacres, colonial dispossession, and apartheid," BNC noted. Moreover, BNC cited the hypocrisy in contrasting responses of the West to human rights violations against Palestine. BNC recommends that people strategically channel their anger by working with progressive networks to pressure governments and parliaments to end military security cooperation trade with apartheid Israel, ban all goods and services in the Zionist regime's illegal settlements, stop material support for pillaged and disputed Israeli fracked gas, and demand a UN investigation of Israeli apartheid.
ocean of dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وكن اللهم بعزتك لي في كل الأحوال رؤوفا وعلي في جميع الأمور عطوفا إلهي وربي من لي غيرك أسأله كشف ضري والنظر في أمري.
Brothers and sisters, in this part of the Kumail supplication, after the supplicant, has confessed to his sins and has confessed to the fact that now he is aware of his own wrongdoings, is asking the Almighty Allah and saying, وَكُنِ اللَّهُمَّ بِعِزَّتِكَ لِي فِي كُلِّ الْأَحْوَالِ رَؤُوفًا. And Allah, by your might, be kind to me in all states. وَعَلَيَّ فِي جَمِيعِ الْأُمُورِ عَطُوفًا. And be gracious to me in all my affairs. By saying this, the supplicant is taking the Almighty Allah as his guardian. He is confessing to the fact that now he is only relying on the Almighty Allah and his mercy to live in this world and the other. Now, he is aware of the vastness of kindness of the Almighty Allah, and no one in the world can describe Almighty Allah's kindness. Because it is really easy and simple to recognize the mercy of the Almighty Allah by paying attention to the different instances in which his mercy can be realized. In the previous episodes, we mentioned some of the instances, and now let us refer to another story about the mercy of the Almighty Allah.
Therefore, my Lord, I ask you by your greatness not to let my sins and my misdeeds veil my supplications from you, and not to disgrace me by exposing those of which you have knowledge, nor to hasten my retribution for those vices and misdeeds committed by me in secret, which were due to evil-mindedness, ignorance, excessive lustfulness, and my negligence. O Allah, I beg you by your greatness to be compassionate to me in all circumstances and be gracious to me in all affairs.
Thank you, Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
Attar Nishaburi says, Abdullah Mubarak had a servant and had promised to set him free if he could work and pay back as much as his price was. One day, someone told Abdullah, your servant opens the graves at night, steals the shrouds of the dead bodies to sell them, and then he is using that money to pay you back, to be freed. The owner of that servant was really upset at hearing this. One night, Abdullah secretly followed the servant to the cemetery, where the servant entered a grave, put on some clothes and a chain around his neck, and he placed his face on the ground. He began supplicating and he began crying, talking to his Lord. Seeing this, Abdullah, his owner, hid himself in a corner and began weeping silently. The servant continued worshipping till the dawn. Then he exited the grave and went toward the city. He entered the first mosque he saw to say his morning prayers. After his prayer, he said, my true Lord, another night finished, and my master asks me for drachmas now. O Allah, you are the provider of the poor. You are the supplier of the unfortunate. At that time, a heavenly light appeared out of which a gold drachma was put in the servant's hand. Abdullah saw this event, and observing this, he was really astonished. He went toward the servant, embraced him and said, may Allah sacrifice me for you. I wish you were my master. I wish I were your servant. The servant said, O Allah, no one knew this secret of mine. Now that it is revealed, I don't want to be alive anymore. Take me to yourself. And then he passed away instantly in Abdullah's hand. It is said that Abdullah buried him in the same old clothes. That night, he dreamed of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam and Prophet Abraham, who were coming to him on a horse, and told him, why did you bury our friend in his old clothes? In fact, the Almighty Allah has mercy on his servants in all of their states, in all of their affairs, in all of their difficulties and situations, and in different forms, specifically in the state of supplication and prayer. Because the nature and the essence of prayer is turning toward the Almighty Allah and getting closer to Him, which is in complete contrast with committing sins and wrongdoings. Brothers and sisters, we are done with this part of the Kumail supplication. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye. Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah. Ya Allah, ya Allah, don't let me go astray, 'cause I need by my side. I wish to be close to you through all my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Okinawa, a Japanese island in the Western Pacific Ocean. The island was the scene of one of the fiercest battles of the Pacific War. It has marked the 50th anniversary of the end of U.S. occupation and its return to Japanese sovereignty after 27 years of U.S. rule. Okinawa returned to Japan on May 15, 1972. However, the island chain still hosts the majority of American military bases in Japan. It harbors about 70% of the U.S.'s military bases in Japan and more than half of its 47,000 troops. Many Japanese people, particularly Okinawans, are against the continued heavy American military presence and are protesting to draw attention to the issue.
Far from being reduced as people in Okinawa demand, the U.S. military bases have even been strengthened instead. We hope the rally will help people in the prefecture and in other places realize the seriousness of the issue.
The presence of U.S. troops in Japan is not in any way intended to protect Japanese citizens, but a part of U.S. military strategy. Frequent incidents caused and crimes committed by U.S. troops in Japan only make Okinawa more dangerous.
Hundreds of protesters from across Japan have staged rallies in Okinawa demanding a reduction of U.S. military forces in the prefecture. In the city of Naha, more than 1,000 people from Tokyo, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, as well as Okinawa held an indoor gathering to call for peace and to oppose U.S. bases. Japanese locals on Okinawa have already been expressing serious opposition to the presence of U.S. forces on the island. A poll by the Asahi Shimbun newspaper and Okinawan media organizations found that 61% of local people wanted fewer U.S. bases on the island, while only 19% said they were happy with the status quo. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, who promised to make a greater effort to reduce hosting U.S. military bases in the region, also acknowledged the issue as well as the economic inequalities that still make Okinawa one of the country's poorest areas.
50 years have passed since Okinawa's reversion to Japan, and the people of Okinawa still bear a heavy burden from the U.S. bases. The government takes this very seriously and will continue to do the utmost to reduce the burden from the bases.
A string of tropical islands located off far southwest Japan, Okinawa, has suffered massive devastation in World War II. Fierce battles between Japanese and American forces left as many as one-third of its people dead. Then around 30 years of U.S. rule followed. And Japan has not forgotten those days. Despite their opposition to U.S. troop presence, Okinawans are more concerned about the threat of a military confrontation involving China. Okinawa is closer to Taiwan than the capital, Tokyo. This could turn it into a target to be the front line in case of a conflict between the U.S. and China. Beijing considers Taiwan as its territory and views U.S. military provocations as a sign of support for those inside Taiwan who seek independence. American warships periodically carry out voyages through the strategic Taiwan Strait, drawing angry responses from China. The U.S. is also the island's key backer and main arms supplier. Tensions in Okinawa are likely to rise further given that lawmakers in the ruling Liberal Democratic Party have said that they want a commitment to more defense spending, including missiles that can hit targets on foreign soil, missiles that could be deployed on Okinawa.
The United States uses its force and uses its bullying tactics to impose its will on other countries. So I don't know that in the minds of the Japanese government that they are really able to operate as totally sovereign, independent entities when it comes to going against the interests of the United States.
Considering the latest developments, Okinawa could soon find itself in the middle of another conflict, one that is reminiscent of a dark point in its history. And this time again, Washington plays a role in it. On May 15, 1948, the Zionist regime forced some 750,000 Palestinians to leave their homes and villages and expelled them into refugee camps that still exist in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Armed Zionist forces massacred entire villages of men, women, and even children. That pushed rightful owners of Palestine to leave their homes and lands as they feared losing their lives. Consequently, that provided the ground for Zionists to establish the Israeli regime. The Palestinians were to suffer further when the West Bank and Gaza fell to the Israelis during the 1967 war, also known as the Six-Day War. Millions of Palestinians, including those displaced since 1948, found themselves under military occupation as well as further Israeli expansionism in their lands. Palestinians want the West Bank as part of a future independent Palestinian state, with East al-Quds as its capital. But Israel's settlement expansion and annexation plans have dealt a serious blow to any prospects of peace. The Gaza Strip has also been under an inhumane Israeli land, air, and sea siege since 2007, and witnessed three wars since 2008. More than 600,000 Israelis currently live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East al-Quds. That's while all Israeli settlement activities are illegal under international law. Every year, Palestinians reaffirm their right to return to their homes and villages in historic Palestine on Nakba Day. They hold annual rallies to commemorate decades of ethnic cleansing of their homeland by the Zionist regime to establish what's known today as Israel. This year, thousands of Palestinians and their supporters across the globe have taken to the streets to hold mass rallies in commemoration of the 74th anniversary of Nakba, or Catastrophe Day, and to condemn the recent killing of a veteran Palestinian journalist by Israeli forces. Shirin Abu Aghaleh was fatally shot by Israeli troops as she was covering an army raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. Targeting the media organizations and journalists isn't an accident. This is systematic targeting of media to create a cloak of secrecy around Israeli crimes.
This is something that is extremely important because it is the part of the historical memory of a culture and people have been subjugated by an illegal occupation of an apartheid regime.
In an expression of solidarity with the people of Palestine, the Iranian Foreign Ministry stated that addressing the issue of Palestine should be the first and foremost issue for the Muslim world, saying any attempt by global Zionism to drive the issue into oblivion would be doomed to failure. The Iranian ministry also stated that the anniversary of Nakba puts on display the failure of international institutions and organizations to resolve one of the longest-running humanitarian and political crises in the world. Israel has managed to get away with its crimes for decades as it enjoys Washington's unwavering support. The U.S. provides the regime with billions of dollars in lethal aid every year. It also invariably uses its veto power at the United Nations to block the world body's anti-Israeli resolutions.
Well, I think that the complicity of basically the Western political class in its entirety and the media in the West is inseparable from the question of Israeli impunity. Israel knows full well that it can do whatever it wants, that it can kill journalists, that it can kill Palestinian children, that it can continue with administrative detention and systematic torture of Palestinian prisoners, and that they'll get away with it because they will never be sanctioned by any of the so-called Western democracies.
This has quietly encouraged the Tel Aviv regime to continue violating the rights of Palestinians and to displace them and to steal their land. But how long will the regime of Tel Aviv be able to extend its illegal existence through carnage and plunder? Former Israeli Premier Ehud Barak has expressed concern about Israel's survival, saying the entity will cease to exist before the 80th anniversary of its 1948 establishment. The ultra-conservative former premier's comments echo prevailing fears in the occupied territories. A recent survey of young Israeli adults found that nearly half of the population in the occupied Palestinian territories is not optimistic about Israel's future, with more than one-third of people thinking about migrating for jobs and better life. Many analysts have pointed to the theory of collapse from within regarding the future of Israel, citing three factors of economic crisis, poor security situation and social divisions for the imminent decline and fall of the regime.
On Wednesday, two journalists covering an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin for Qatari broadcaster Al Jazeera came under attack. Ali Al-Samoudi was shot in the back but survived. His colleague, Shirin Abu Akla, however, wasn't as lucky. The reporter was shot in the head and was pronounced dead after being rushed to the hospital. The attack came despite them both wearing vests with the word press emblazoned on them.
It wants the image of absolute lawlessness and operating with impunity. What could be more criminal than the targeted assassination? And just to say how strongly the whole world feels and the outrage at the assassination of Shirin Abu Akleh.
Also, according to eyewitnesses, the attack was unprovoked as there was no confrontation between Palestinians and the regime's forces at the time of the assault on the journalists.
The occupation is murderous and criminal. They shot us for no reason. We, a group of journalists, were there wearing our full press uniform in addition to the helmets with the word press written in large letters, as big as the whole world. We were obvious. We made sure to walk right in front of the army patrols so that they can see us and they saw us after we went to a road where there were no armed people, no civilians, and there were no shooting and no incidents there. We were shocked by the shooting. I was lucky and I turned my back when the first bullet was shot and injured my back. They wanted to kill me. I was injured in my back, and the second bullet shot my colleague Shireen and caused her death.
But the regime didn't spare Abu Akla, even at her funeral. Israeli troops attacked mourners carrying the slain journalist's casket outside the hospital, causing the coffin to almost fall to the ground. She was later laid to rest in a cemetery in occupied East Al-Quds. The journalist's killing and the subsequent attack during her funeral were met with international condemnation, with Israel's closest ally, the United States, calling it, quote, deeply concerning. The United Nations human rights experts have called the incident a serious attack on the freedom of media and expression and called for a transparent investigation. The case of the journalist set to be brought to the International Criminal Court, a tribunal that has in the past attempted to probe Israel's rights violations and war crimes against Palestinians, but failed to do so due to political pressure and sanctions from the United States. Israel's aggression against countries like Syria and Lebanon has also been protested in the international arena. But so far, the reactions from the international community have been limited to verbal support. That begs the question, will Tel Aviv face any accountability for its crimes?
Within international courts, because who controls international courts? And who controls the International Criminal Court while they're not even a signer to it? That's U.S. imperialism. So I don't think Israel will be brought to any kind of justice or accountability through this. But I think it's up to the people of the world. It's up to all honest reporters, journalists, and news services to make sure that this does not go unmarked.
Some observers also ascribe the intensified Israeli pressure on Palestinians to some Arab states' moves to normalize ties with the regime. The Arab states had claimed that their decisions would help the Palestinian cause, an excuse that has repeatedly proven to be nothing more than mere window dressing over the past 2 years. Many Palestinians believe that in the absence of any international accountability, resistance remains their only way forward.
A state of shock in America, especially among members of the Native American community, following the identification of over 500 student deaths at U.S. boarding schools. The deaths of Native American children were confirmed as part of the first stage of a federal study of boarding schools that operated for over a century. They were supposed to assimilate the indigenous children into white society between 1819 and 1969. The number of deaths could be only the tip of the iceberg, as the U.S. Interior Department warns that with further investigation, the number of known student deaths could climb to the thousands or even tens of thousands. The initial findings of the comprehensive study have turned a spotlight on the dark history of more than 400 Native American boarding schools notorious for brutal conditions. Hundreds of thousands of indigenous children were forced by the U.S. federal government to attend the institutions. The children were separated from their families by force, forbidden from speaking their languages, and often abused. A large number of them never returned home. The painful legacy of the notorious system operated by the government and churches has been felt deeply across Indian country and through generations. The high-profile federal review was ordered by U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland last year after the discovery of unmarked graves at the site of former residential schools in neighboring Canada.
So it's the same history, really. There's really, the thing is, the United States had such a huge population of Native people, such a wealth of anthropology. If you could imagine what anthropologists today would give to be able to hurriedly record all those languages and take pictures, but they're gone. You can't even record the dead civilizations. And if they were allowed to live, the Earth would be so much wealthier. It's really just a terrible, terrible tragedy. That is the real genocide. That's genocide number one.
The U.S. Interior Department's report was released on Wednesday. It highlighted instances of beating, withholding of food and solitary confinement, and other forms of abuse at U.S. boarding schools. U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, whose grandparents attended such schools, seems to be very serious about the investigation. She has ordered her agency to fully investigate what remains of the evidence of the horrific abuses.
Now we are uniquely positioned to assist in the effort to recover the dark history of these institutions that have haunted our families for too long.
She says the consequences of federal Indian boarding school policies, including the trauma caused by the family separation and cultural eradication inflicted on generations of children as young as 4 years old, are heartbreaking and undeniable. Brian Newland, the Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Indian Affairs, believes further investigation is needed to better understand the lasting effects of the boarding school system on American Indians. Newland said there is not a single American Indian, Alaskan Native, or Native Hawaiian in the country whose life has not been impacted by the notorious boarding school system. Meanwhile, the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition warned that efforts to find the remains of the indigenous children must continue until the United States fully accounts for the genocide committed against Native American children. The latest findings are shedding light on the plight of Native Americans in the United States. They are still suffering from many problems, including racial discrimination. Pressure is mounting on the U.S. establishment to come to terms with and learn lessons from its dark past.
Cultural news. Social news. Scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Tehran is hosting the 33rd International Book Fair in person for the first time after 2 years of lockdown as a result of COVID-19. This has caused enthusiasts to visit the fair for new titles. Saman Kujuri has the story.
The 33rd Tehran International Book Fair is underway in the Iranian capital, with over 1,700 Iranian as well as 170 foreign publishers attending the event. It is the first time after 2 years of lockdown as a result of the COVID-19 that the Tehran International Book Fair is being held both in person and online. As the top Iranian book event, the fair has millions of visitors every year, including thousands of university students, scholars, and their families.
I'm very happy to see that the book fair has once again opened its doors to the visitors in person after 2 years of lockdown as a result of the COVID-19. I love reading books. To me, the Tehran Book Fair is my favorite event.
For me, the book fair is an opportunity to get my kids familiar with books. I try to take them to different book fairs so as to teach them that book is a necessity in our life. I want to raise my children with the love for book reading.
A huge number of national visitors, along with international exhibitors from different countries, make this event one of the unique cultural events. The book fair is a good opportunity for publishers to showcase their new products.
technology AR واقعیت.
We have designed our educational books based on augmented reality, which is an interactive experience of a real world environment where the objects that reside in the real world are enhanced by computer generated perceptual information, and students can watch educational films related to any specific topic. It will help students better understand educational topics.
It is said that books give a soul to the universe, wings to the mind, flight to the imagination, and life to everything. And this is exactly what the Book Fair tries to help you achieve.
By reading books, we feel healthy is the motto of the 33rd edition of the Taiwan International Book Fair, which will be running through May 21st at Imam Khomeini's Musalla. Saman Kujirip, Tehran.
A group of over a dozen penguins has been released back to the sea after being given a second chance to live.
The condition of these specimens, which fortunately could be reinserted, is very common to find. They are animals that appear stranded on the coast, found with malnutrition, dehydration, hypothermia, and a high degree of parasitism. Specialists call this condition the stranded penguin syndrome.
The penguins were rescued and taken to the Mondo Marino Foundation, where they were rehabilitated. They were kept warm and were fed liquids until they could eat fish again. Before their release, blood and other samples were taken, and a chip was implanted to track them. One of the penguins was a southern rockhopper, which is a species listed as endangered. Biologists at a rescue center say there are many reasons why penguins get stranded and malnourished. These include overfishing, global warming, and other environmental changes. Thousands of people crowd into the British city of Norwich to watch a 2-kilometer-long string of dominoes topple, while winding through town. Some 7,500 breeze blocks were set up for the event. The dominoes slinked through street buildings, windows, and even climbed up stairs and trees. The toppling lasted 30 minutes. The moving sculpture was installed across the city with the help of some 200 volunteers. The artistic director said the work was chosen partly because it was a spectacle and both disrupted the city and engaged its people.
There's a sense of anticipation that goes with the work. You would have seen people around town at the moment. Everybody's asking, what's going on, what's going on? And then when they realise what it is, then there's this sense of, oh, and when are you going to knock it over? So that it's a sculpture also that gets destroyed in many ways, and that's really part of the work as well. I mean, I like to think about it as a child almost playing with the city. You know, they're setting everything up, and we all know they're going to knock it down at some point, and that's fun.
Daniel Bryan said he was excited about the project because it looked like a child had taken over the city with the joy of knocking down dominoes. The cascading dominoes ran through two cities, eventually ending at the site of Norfolk and Norwich Festival of Arts. The organizers say the goal of the installation was to bring unity to the community.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Chilean paleontologists unearthed a rare, fully intact fossil of what is known as a sea dragon discovered from a melting glacier deep in Patagonia.
It is the first complete and excavated ichthyosaur that has been found in Chile. It also corresponds to one of the most complete fossils ever found on the planet for the Cretaceous period. It is the only pregnant ichthyosaur that's been found on the planet from the era between 129 and 139 million years ago. So it's incredibly important.
The 4-meter-long fossil is nicknamed Fiona and swam the seas some 250 million years ago. Scientists say this specimen will help them understand this species and its embryonic development. The expedition lasted over a month because of the remote nature of the find in the Patagonian glaciers. Paleontologists had to make a 10-hour hike just to get to the site. They also had to camp in extreme weather conditions while maneuvering tricky, rocky surfaces. But collecting and transporting the fossil was a whole other story.
As we went down excavating, weakening the rock, we realized the skeleton was mostly complete, so much that the bones were pushed inwards and we had to make five blocks of approximately 200 kilos each to move it.
The blocks were then airlifted to the Rio Seco Natural History Museum in southern Chile to be prepared for exhibition. The fossil was first discovered by Ruth Pedro more than a decade ago, but because of the site's harsh terrain, its extraction was a complex challenge. Scientists also discovered over 20 other specimens of the same species during the expedition, bringing the total found in the glacier area to 100.
Stopping by and listening to street musicians usually changes our mood for the rest of the day. The experience would be different if one lies under the instrument while it is being played. And that's exactly what a pianist in America has done. Colin Huggins, a busker, wheels his grand piano more than a half a mile from a mini storage to New York's Washington Square Park. He lets people lie down under the instrument and feel the vibrations from the claviers in their bodies. Colin says he wants to help people recover emotionally from the intense disconnect they had faced during COVID lockdowns.
I've always wanted to accommodate feelings in the best way possible, and I wanted to do it with music, and this is the best way I figure out how to do it. Maybe someday I'll figure out a way to do it even better, and I won't need to push this piano here. But as of now, this is the best I've got.
New York was one of the hardest hit cities by COVID in the U.S. Like other places, the major city imposed lockdowns and tough curbs to contain the virus. Despite that, Colin continued playing on the streets, frequently to an audience of zero. He says he strongly believes that everything will be okay. Cambodian fishermen aiming for small fish were shocked to see the surprise catch tied to their hook. This creature was nothing but an endangered giant freshwater stingray, which had swallowed the fishermen's catch. It was 4 meters long and weighed 180 kilos. The female leviathan is one of the rarest species of fish in Southeast Asia. Therefore, a team of international experts helped unhook the stingray to release it back to the waters unharmed.
All right, so we've just released our giant stingray back into the wild. She's kind of hanging out on the surface of the river here. It's amazing to be able to see her swimming around in her natural habitat and to have participated in the release of this giant stingray today.
The giant stingray was caught in the Mekong River, an important habitat for different species of fish, including huge catfish and barb. However, experts say the river's underwater ecosystem has been damaged by massive plastic wastes. Environmentalists constantly warn that building dams on the Mekong River is also destroying its large fish stock.
Scaling Mount Everest is only a dream for many and a once-in-a-lifetime achievement for most professional mountaineers. Well, not for this Nepali Sherpa, who has now repeated the feat for a record 26th time. 52-year-old Kami Rita led a group of other Sherpa climbers along the traditional Southeast Ridge route to the world's tallest peak. In the process, he beat his own previous record set last year. Rita first scaled Everest in 1994 and has been making the trip nearly every year since then. The Sherpa community is an ethnic group indigenous to the Himalayan region. They are expert mountain navigators who also carry heavy loads. Everest stands nearly 9,000 meters above sea level. The mountain has been climbed more than 10,000 times since it was first scaled in 1953. The bad news is more than 300 people have died trying. Chinese scientists are establishing a meteorological monitoring station at an altitude of 8,800 meters on Mount Komolangma, the world's highest peak on the China-Nepal border. The 13 members of the research team started the trek towards an 8,300-meter base camp on Mount Komolangma from a 7,028-meter camp on Tuesday morning. They reached the camp in the afternoon and went on the last section of the arduous journey up on Wednesday morning. It replaces the one at an altitude of 8,430 meters set up by the British and U.S. scientists on the mountains in 2019.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.